This week, a diplomatic fallout over a bombshell allegation by a United States ambassador. Did South Africa supply arms to Russia? We'll discuss the coming investigation, the lingering questions, and why this could not have come at a worse time for the relationship between Pretoria and Washington. Also, an exclusive VOA reporting trip takes you into the heart of the fighting between the army and rebels in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll bring you in-depth reporting on the experiences of the people caught in the conflict. Straight Talk Africa starts now.
The government of South Africa is in fact not aligned. Amongst the things that we noted were the docking of the Russian cargo ship Lady R in Simonstown between December 6th and December 8th, 22, which we are confident uploaded weapons, ammunition onto that vessel in Simonstown as it made its way back to Russia, which does not suggest to us the actions of a non-aligned country.
Hello there and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Heidi Adams. That was the bombshell allegation made last week by the U.S. ambassador to South Africa, Reuben Brigati. Comments that sparked a diplomatic storm between Pretoria and Washington. The South African government says it is investigating the matter. And during question time in Parliament, the leader of South Africa's opposition Democratic Alliance, John Steenhuisen, asked President Cyril Ramaphosa about it.
It's been half a year now since the scandal of the Lady R docking in Simonstown broke. And I find it inconceivable that a president worth his salt would not have been briefed on the situation by now. Mr. President, can you confirm whether weapons of war were loaded on board that Russian ship before she left Simonstown?
We are all aware of the news that we all became aware of the Lady R, and that whole matter, Honorable Steenhuisen, is being looked into. It's being looked into, and whilst the process continues, I want you to allow that process to continue to reach its fruition. I know that you are so keen and you are so interested in knowing exactly what happened. The matter is being looked into, and in time we'll be able to speak about it.
Now, Washington says it welcomes Pretoria's investigation into the matter, but are the U.S. ambassador's claims true? For more on this diplomatic saga and its ramifications, Govan Whittles in Johannesburg, South Africa, joins me. He's a political correspondent with VOA News affiliate Newsroom Africa. Also joining us is foreign policy analyst Sanusha Naidu. She's a research associate with the Global Institute for Dialogue, and she joins us via Skype from Cape Town. Govan and Sanusha, a warm welcome to both of you. And Govan, I want to start with you now. Newsroom Africa covered the U.S. ambassador's press conference in Pretoria last week. Tell us, what do you know about the timing of Ambassador Brigati's statement? And what exactly did he apologize for? I mean, he said he crossed a line, but does that mean he's saying he lied?
Well, it doesn't mean that he says he lied. What's interesting about the timing of the allegation made by Ambassador Brigati is that, firstly, at the press conference, there were whispers that the ambassador was seeking to force South Africa to bring out into the open an agreement to conduct an investigation into what happened with the Lady R vessel in Cape Town, in Simonstown, after having agreed to it when South Africa sent an envoy to the U.S. in the form of its Deputy Minister of International Relations and its de facto head of intelligence, Dr. Sydney Mufamadi. That's where they initially agreed to investigate investigate the matter with a retired judge. And it appears the U.S. was under the impression that once the envoy returned home, they would announce that this investigation is underway. The timing was also interesting because a long-planned trip by the head of the South African Army to Moscow was on the verge of happening. That is currently underway and has been criticized in the wake of the allegations that South Africa provided arms to Russia. And then it's also interesting because of the announcement by South Africa's president that he would form part of a delegation of the African Union that would essentially conduct a peace mission and meet with Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, as well as Ukraine's president separately, of course, to check the prospect of peace. That's interesting because now South Africa has been accused of arming Russia. The other country involved in that peace mission is Egypt, which has also been accused of wanting to supply 40,000 rockets to Russia. And then finally, reports in South Africa indicated that South Africa is in the process of trying to facilitate diplomatic immunity for the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, if he attends the BRICS summit, and that the Russian government has indicated to South Africa that they're not willing to conduct a virtual summit and that Vladimir Putin is insisting that he should come to South Africa. So South Africa under pressure to host the Russian president, seeking a way to do so without breaching its status of non-aligned in that conflict.
Sanusha, I want to get back to some of these points that Govan just mentioned, but I want your assessment of what the state of the relationship between Washington and Pretoria is like. What was it like before this latest saga, and how much damage has been done here by Ambassador Brigitte making the allegation, and whether or not there are now questions whether or not his allegations are true?
Good day, Heidi, and good day to your government. I think, you know, before this whole saga had emerged with regard to this allegations around the arms question, I think the U.S. and South Africa had really coherent, cohesive, cordial relations. Yes, there would be tensions in terms of particular positioning, etc. I mean, before COVID, there were issues around questions around how trade would be managed, etc. But it never came to this kind of volatility. Even when the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, was here last year launching the Sub-Saharan Africa strategy for the U.S., I think even then our Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Dr. Naledi Pandor, made it very clear about how South Africa's position would be in terms of its in relation to the conflict between Ukraine and Russia, and more importantly, in terms of how it seeks to position itself in the context of non-alignment or non-aligned. And I think to a large extent, there was a sense of respectfulness that Secretary of State Anthony Blinken had acknowledged in that press briefing last year. I think what this incident has now done as a result of what the ambassador has now said that he has it on good authority and he bets his life on it, quote unquote, is that it now means that South Africa is in a state where its partnership with the U.S. is under some serious scrutiny, but also in a very volatile position. Now, it could be for a number of reasons, as Govan has also highlighted in terms of the timing of it. But others have also raised in the South African media and outside of our media that it's about the relationship with regard to trade. We are basically going to be undermining AGOA, which is going to be discussed in August, and where we fit in this whole question of losing a lot of trade, which is amounting to a couple of billions of rand stroke dollars. And I think to a large extent, this is now really how you have to deal with our mission in Washington and how that's going to be trying to navigate this crisis and navigate this reputational risk, but also a credibility risk for us. Because now we are coming across in the context of global reputational brand as a country that's being a bit is seen as not necessarily sticking to the script. But I think here's what I want to put in as a sidebar note. You know, when it comes to arms deals across the world, wherever you are, any country that deals in arms and however they deal with arms, they open up a Pandora's box, whether it's in the Ukraine crisis or whether we're talking about the arms that is suddenly sitting a flush in Sudan and there's a crisis in Sudan today.
Very, very interesting indeed. And Govan, I want to know from you, the South African media largely being as independent as it is, how is the story being covered in South African media? What are journalists looking to find out here about this? And how is it playing out in the public there?
Well, the South African government is under immense pressure to clarify what exactly happened with the Lady Art vessel because of the reporting by South African journalists. It's been covered through pictures of Lady Art in the Simonstown dock. What was confirmed by the South African government is that when the vessel docked here, it actually offloaded weapons which were ordered from the Russian government before the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the Department of Defense, and they insist that nothing was uploaded. The International Relations Minister confirming to journalists that there have been no agreements to sell weapons to Russia through the Arms Control Commission here in South Africa, and that if anything like that was done, it would have been a breach of the law and someone would need to be investigated. And then journalists pressing the Defense Minister of South Africa for a clear statement on what happened, and she's offered a categorical denial that anything was sent to Russia. That's the government on the record because of the pressure from the journalists. The public, of course, feel disappointed that their tax money may have been used to arm the Russian government in the Ukraine conflict, although many of them are skeptical that this has even happened. The Democratic Alliance, which is the main opposition party, suspects that it may have happened. It wants the outcome of that investigation. On the other end of the spectrum, to the left, we have the Economic Freedom Fighters, which says that it doubts South Africa has the capacity to do so and has called for the expulsion of the American ambassador from South Africa. And in the middle, the African National Congress, which is the governing party, today holding a meeting with Ambassador Brigidi to smooth things over and saying that they don't believe it's necessary for him to be expelled. And they say that he reiterated his apology. So political parties reflecting the pressure that the public is putting on the government, and which has emerged since the revelation, which was really brought out by Ambassador Brigidi. What's clear is that before he said this, the South African public didn't know that it may have happened. Now that he said it, the South African public is demanding clear answers and evidence on whether or not the country did or did not supply any arms to Russia.
Yeah, indeed.
Of course, the Kremlin also denies it.
Right. Indeed. I mean, this seems now to be a bell that cannot be unrung. Sanusha, what is the relationship? What's the nature of the real relationship between South Africa and Russia? Is there more to it than just, you know, gratitude and, you know, a sense of nostalgia for the Soviet Union's support for the African National Congress and a wide array of liberation movements across the continent during the struggle for independence and freedom?
Well, I think it does have a historical relationship, and we can't ignore that historical relationship based on the issues of the politics of liberation, the role that Moscow played in the African liberation movements. And of course, the ANC does recognize that and continuously talks about it in its context when it refers to the relationship with Russia. I think also what becomes interesting in the South African context as well is how much South Africa, particularly in its relationship with Russia, is informed by the BRICS. And the fact that South Africa is a member of the BRICS, is hosting the 15th BRICS summit this year in August. And of course, it raises questions about also the policy positioning of South Africa, particularly in the ANC, but also in government, around this notion of an independent foreign policy or a foreign policy that says we can actually engage with who we want to engage with. I remember very concisely in 1997-98, when South Africa hosted the Non-Aligned Summit, President Mandela was there and he was welcoming everybody, saying, "You all are our friends." And in international relations, I think this becomes a very difficult situation where now interests basically need to be defined in terms of friendship. So I think South Africa's caught, and particularly the government is caught, the ANC-led government is caught in this crosshairs of what we are seeing in terms of the global narrative of how Russia is portrayed. The fact that there has been a transgression and a territorial dispute and dispute of sovereignty with regard to what Russia did in Ukraine, but is also now beginning to play out in narratives in the South African context, as well as more globally in terms of this positioning of whether or not you support us or you don't support us. And I think this kind of finds this situation in South Africa, particularly for the government, in a very precarious situation. It wants to assert itself as an independent country, but of course its foreign policy is weakened because it sees these dynamics as being pushed into a corner. And finally, just to mention, I think the challenge really is for South Africa to be much more coherent in terms of saying, and I think this is where it can learn lessons, to say, well, we have a strategic autonomy of interest in foreign policy. And so even if we are in the BRICS, I think we should not allow other countries to determine who to do business with.
And I think South Africa has, over the years, found itself in these crosshairs before, especially when it came to relationships with the Palestinians, with the Cubans, etc. But this is a fascinating, these are fascinating developments, and we'll continue to follow them. But thank you so much for your insights, for your reporting, Sanusha Naidoo and Govan Whittles. I do appreciate your time very much. Thank you. Well, we're going to take a short break here, and when Straight Talk Africa returns, we'll take you to the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. A VOA team traveled there to report on the armed conflict in that country and the impact on the people caught in the middle. My colleague Paul Ndio joins me after the break. You do not want to miss this. Stay with us. With Straight Talk Africa, welcome back. We turn our attention now to the Democratic Republic of Congo and the armed conflict between the Congolese army and rebel groups, including M23, in the eastern parts of the country. The United Nations says the fighting has left a trail of destruction, including reported mass killings, violence against women and children, and the displacement of an estimated 100,000 people. Now, my VOA colleagues Paul Ndio and Omari Kaseko spent 2 weeks in the conflict zone to see what life is like for the people caught in the fighting. And what they found was absolutely harrowing. And Paul Ndio joins me now. Paul, you know, you've been talking to us in recent days about your experiences. We're now seeing the visuals of what actually happened. First of all, great reporting going into the and getting to the heart of the story. But tell us first about this conflict in itself. I mean, why is this conflict happening, and why has it caused these military tensions between the DRC and Rwanda?
Thank you, Heidi, for having me. The East African regional forces have taken over strategic positions that were once held by M23 rebels. So my colleague Omari Kaseko and I had the dubious privilege of touring some of these places that have been taken that had been taken by M23 rebels and now under the control of the East African Regional Forces.
Well, let's take a look.
The East African Regional Force, who have taken over these locations, have forced the M23 rebels out of strategic positions in the DRC. M23 rebels previously controlled the towns of Kibumba, Rumangabo, Rushuru, Masisi and Bunagana. Now, residents can finally breathe a sigh of relief as the East African Regional Forces, working with their Congolese counterparts, have seized control of the area.
When we talk about the impact of war, this is what we are talking about. As you can see, there is not a single human being in this house. Most of these people have fled. They are somewhere in a refugee camp.
The road closure between Bunagana and Goma is causing financial hardship for people in the region. The M23 rebels captured the Bunagana border town last year, cutting off all major supply routes for Ugandan and Kenyan goods to Goma, Eastern DRC.
This is Bunagana town center. A lot of people here don't even want to talk to us because guess what? This is M23's stronghold.
How are you?
I'm fine.
What's your name? Maelemo. Hapa na kusema mingi sisi.
Unaweza kuongea kuzungumza na mimi kidogo kidogo?
Mimi si mzuri mzuri.
Ni vya ndo ndagana?
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you do here in Ndagana?
Ndagana, there is no problem.
Unataka kuongea na wewe?
Mimi sitaki kuongea na wewe.
We are being told that we need to get back in our cars because there is people crowding around. For security reasons, we need to get back in our cars.
Life is in limbo for hundreds of thousands of people in the IDP camps of Congo. Many families left their traditional homelands as the conflict started.
We are hungry. Here we don't have what to eat, so we are asking for help.
Many citizens thought it would be a temporary situation and they would soon get back to their daily lives.
We are praying that they finish the war because hunger is killing us.
In Bulengo camp, about 15 kilometers west of Goma, a measles outbreak is causing major concern among the internally displaced persons.
It's a severe problem when kids are dying here. That's why we have launched this aggressive campaign to vaccinate the kids. But unfortunately, most of the kids are dying of malaria, measles, and cholera.
We thank them for bringing us the vaccine for measles. But unfortunately, many children have died here.
Nearly 13,000 UN peacekeeping troops are deployed in the DRC to end the bloody civil war that ravaged the country for more than 20 years. Since then, MONUSCO has been working to maintain peace and stability in the country. But of course, not without challenges.
Along these 20 years, we were able to provide some kind of security for the people from North Kivu. I know that now this challenge, it's in our hands again. But we were able to provide some security for the people from North Kivu.
Only some people are happy with the presence of MONUSCO in the DRC. Demonstrators have been rallying in the streets, demanding that the UN peacekeeping force be withdrawn from the country.
The Congolese people are standing here to say that they don't want MONUSCO to stay here, because they have shown that there is no solution they are bringing an end to the conflict. We have learned that whatever problems we have here, MONUSCO is part of them.
Despite the protests, MONUSCO remains dedicated to its role in the country, and it is optimistic that with continued collaboration between all stakeholders, they can make significant progress in ending the violence in the country.
Well, my colleague Paul Ndio and Omari Katseko reporting there in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. And Paul, I want to pull up a map here just so that our viewers can see exactly where you were. You were in the eastern part of the DRC. And just to give our audience even more context, can you tell us a little bit more about where you were, where exactly, which places you visited?
Thanks again, Heidi. The thing is, Congo is a very fascinating place. It's a very, very wide in terms of scale. So we had the privilege of going to Kibumba, an area that has been deserted. You drive in those places, there's not a single soul out there. Most people are in refugee camps. Then we went to Rushuru. Rushuru, that's like the one of the strategic towns that has been held by the M23 rebels. It connects Bunagana, the border. We also visited the border area that connects Uganda to DRC. And another area that is now strategic for the East African Regional Forces is Masisi. Masisi is one of those places that everybody, it's like the Switzerland of Africa. When you look at the terrain, you look at all the minerals come from that part of the country. So those are the places that we visited on our trip.
And Paul, you know, one can't help but empathize and really feel for the people, the ordinary people who are trapped in the middle of this inner conflict zone. What were you hoping to capture through your reporting and considering the people that you spoke to?
You know, what struck me was the simple fact that with everything that has been going on in the DRC for over the last 20 years, you still have over a million internally displaced persons who are just stranded in IDP camps all over the place. Wherever you go, you find camps all over the place. So we had we visited a couple of places, a couple of camps in and around Goma, and I was struck by the sheer level of poverty. There is no food, no water, no medication. People are just there fending for themselves. You have women who have gone through all sorts of things. Like every woman we talk to has a story. She's been raped multiple times. You have young children who are dealing with similar things. I mean, I think one of the stories that resonated with me as I have two young daughters, and I was looking at girls the age of my daughters, and I just couldn't contain myself. It was just heartbreaking to see these young girls. They have to deal with this kind of stuff. They have no hope, no future for them.
And here you look at, here's yet another generation in that country of young people and the kind of violence that they have to live with and are exposed to on a daily basis. But speaking of the violence and those who have been brought in to essentially keep the peace, we see a lot of resistance in that story to MONUSCO not being, these UN peacekeeping forces not being welcomed by some communities in this region. We see protests and some even saying that they are the problem. Why do they, what do they tell you about why they say or believe that?
To a large extent, MONUSCO has been there for over 20 years. People see MONUSCO, they say, you guys, you have been here for over 20 years, but there's nothing really to show for it. On the other hand, MONUSCO has played a significant role. The semblance of peace that we see in the region, it's precisely because MONUSCO has been able to bring that peace in place. Before that, there was chaos all over the place. The other point I could make here is that you have over 120 militia groups. You have external and internal forces who are coming in. They all want to take something from Congo. Mm. So, like, M23 is part of the problem, but not the whole problem, you see? So you have other external elements. You also have corporations involved in this thing. You have people who have money, a lot of money. They all have militia groups. So it's almost impossible to tell.
All these competing interests.
The likes of Wagner in the mix.
Absolutely. And now, Paul, from what you've seen, what's being done to address the humanitarian situation there? I mean, what kind of resources are available?
I mean, the unfortunate part is that we talk to a lot of people in these refugee camps, or IDP. They call them internal displaced camps. We talk to a lot of people in there. Most people were hungry. They didn't have water or food or medicine. And when we talk to the aid agencies on the ground, including International Red Cross, they said, look, the funding we had before the war in Ukraine was sufficient, but now there's zero, almost zero funding, because most of the funds are going to the war in Ukraine. So almost all those people who used to depend on some of these resources coming into to help, like the people in Congo, are not there. So you have people literally going out there trying to find money, jobs here and there, to just to take care of basic needs.
International politics playing out in very real terms for people in their daily lives. And speaking of politics, Paul, there is an election coming up in the DRC. What does this conflict mean for President Tshisekedi, Felix Tshisekedi, and his bid for a second term?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question. I think the reason you see a lot of players right now, a lot of things happening in the DRC, is because it's election season. Elections are coming up in December, and Tshisekedi wants to use this as leverage. So that's why he's bringing in external forces. For example, we have the East African forces on the ground, but now they're bringing in SADC because he's under pressure to perform. People are saying, hey, Mr. President, you have not done enough. People in Eastern Congo are still dying. What are you doing about this? So let me bring in SADC. Let me bring in Wagner.
Right. And we've seen him speak in Botswana saying that he would welcome SADC troops. And that could, you know, create a whole different dynamic there as well. If you have the East Africa regional forces, SADC in the region.
Yeah, but very briefly, if I could add, the youth is mounting pressure on Tshisekedi and other politicians to make sure that they bring this thing to an end, because it's been going on for too long.
Absolutely. Yeah. Paul Ndiaye, great reporting. We look forward to more of the stories that you've covered there. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your work. We really appreciate it.
A pleasure being on your show, Heidi. Thank
and
you.
That is it for us this week. Do catch all the latest news from across the African continent on voaafrica.com, and do follow Straight Talk Africa.